our next presenter, Ambassador Frederick Myers, Barton, excuse me. Of course, Georgette, you're going to stay with us because we're going to have a panel later on.
Yes.
Very good. I'm very happy to welcome as presenter Ambassador Frederick Barton, who will speak on the heart of peacebuilding, citizens. Ambassador Barton is a peacebuilder, a public servant, a change advancer, and a friend. Ambassador Frederick Barton teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, where he, that actually may be changed, the name may be changed, he can correct us, teaches at that school at Princeton University, where he serves as a co-director of Princeton Scholars in the Nation's Service Initiative and Ullman Fellowships. His 2018 book, Peace Works, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World, describes an affirmative approach to foreign affairs through concrete and attainable solutions. Ambassador Barton started USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives. He was America's ambassador to the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations in New York, and he was the UN's deputy High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva. He was the first Assistant Secretary of State for Conflict and Stabilization Operations. He led conflict management initiatives in over 40 crisis zones across the globe, from Haiti, Iraq, Nigeria, Burma, Pakistan, to Turkey. Ambassador Barton.
Great. Thanks. Thank you so much, Richard. Thank you for inviting us to this great exchange of ideas. We just don't have these kinds of opportunities any longer. It's really hard to think of what American leaders are taking time off from their very busy lives to actually reflect, to imagine what is most important, and to develop some original thinking. So your inspiration is a great challenge for all of us, and particularly in this kind of whirling world that we live in, where there's so much, so many opinions, and only some facts and information to tether those opinions to. It's a sparkling day here in Maine, as I'm sure Winslow, Ambassador Myers, would attest. And it's a real pleasure to be part of this. I want to just briefly state that I believe in a more perfect union anchored in the people of our country, informed by an engaged citizenry, and committed to constant improvement. I believe that peace is a central American interest. The vision that I hope to share today speaks to my work in building peace and how the United States can and must play a unifying role in a turbulent world. At the heart of peacebuilding are citizens. So what I will try to do today is to point out and critique our current situation and context, and then offer six very practical guideposts and six doable ideas that I envision will further engage the U.S. public and our leaders in peace building. There's so much to be said. This is not the final word by a long shot. So it's great to be with you. I do also want to thank a mutual friend of a number of us, Lola O'Byrne, who passed away in the last year, but really encouraged our participation, and who, when she moved back to the United States from Mexico, really believed in our system, in the beauty of our system, and the potential of our people-centered model. So I really do this in tribute to her because she was such an inspiration. I also will say that I think Georgette's words, in particular what she said about solutions and what High Commissioner Filippo Grandi is going to be really the emphasis of what I'm going to talk about. So let's just take a quick look at the current situation, the context, which I believe includes the following. I believe that the last several wars that the United States has been engaged in we've been almost guilty of conflict tourism. We did not have congressional votes to authorize these conflicts, so our representatives did not have to face these difficult debates, and they could really kibitz throughout. We did not have tax increases, so we didn't have to pay for any of these hundreds of billions of dollars that we spend in Iraq and Afghanistan. And only 1% of U.S. families were directly involved in these conflicts, as opposed to our historical standard of about 40% of American families that had a member in the armed services. So our all-voluntary military has removed sort of the direct ownership that we used to find. That is not a healthy way for a democracy to engage in something as serious as a foreign conflict. Obviously, Afghanistan and Iraq have brought that home in spades, but that is true of really over the last 20 conflicts that we have intervened in. I believe that we have an overwhelmingly militaristic and citizen-led approach to these conflicts, with well over 90% of our resources are spent on military initiatives. We have 800 bases or footprints now in over 70 countries. That's obviously dwarfs any diplomatic efforts that we might be making. There is growing global skepticism about the U.S. leadership and our role. And starting back in 2014, somebody who I think has missed a number of beats, but really saw this correctly, Henry Kissinger spoke of America's, quote, increasingly ambivalent role on the world stage. And he asked, are we facing a period in which forces beyond the restraints of any order determine the future? He and so many others spoke of increasing our interdependence. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was, you know, a little bit of a Cold War warrior, also said, Our relationships can only be either reciprocally cooperative or mutually damaging. Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, was describing this metamorphosis as a period of problems without borders. A number of conventional national security experts today, like Michael O'Hanlon, describe this shift from the 4+1 threats that we used to have, which would have been China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and terrorism, to a new 4+1, which he describes as bio war disease, cyber, nukes, climate, and domestic divisions. So I have my own view, as you might expect, and what I'd like to offer is 6 guideposts that will then lead to 6 practical ideas. My first is that I think we're living in a period of mutual assured destruction. MAD, the way that's synthesized, was the description that we had for nuclear warfare, and the reason that people would never pursue a nuclear war is that it guaranteed their own destruction. So it was a war of suicide. I happen to believe that almost every one of today's major issues is now a MAD concern. So it's not just nukes, but it's also climate, it's terrorism, it's cyber, it's conflict, it's trade, it's health, and it's more. So if we decide to use our cyber warfare to do something in North Korea, it's not long before anybody from a North Korean teenager to an active member of their government can come along and knock out 16 hospitals around New York City, if they so choose. So the consequences today seem more personal. It's not just that your flood insurance is going up if you happen to live on the coast, but obviously the entire COVID phenomena has shown us just how complicated this can be on a personal level. So the interdependence is growing, and groups such as One Shared World, with its own declaration of interdependence, are springing up and signing up a couple million people in short order, because there is a growing recognition, although not a full acceptance, of this phenomena of our time. The second guidepost that I would use is that the U.S. and a few other nations still enjoy preferential status in a range of world bodies, from the UN to the World Bank, et cetera. And we are resented as, these are resented as entitlements. And many times it has led us and other preferential countries to cut corners. Now, in most every negotiation that I was involved with at the State Department and at AID, the U.S. is a key negotiator and a key contributor to a range of issues, though we never joined the eventual treaties or agreements, and which is really ironic because our practices often exceed the international standards that we have just helped to negotiate. That obviously has to change. The third guidepost that I would offer is that we must cultivate what I consider silenced majorities. The vast majority of the world is under 25 and happens to be female. These are two groups that are really have been effectively silenced in important decision-making. And we've got to find a way to bring them forward if we're going to ever have a foreign policy that is driven by putting people first, that respects local voices, and that is committed to finding catalytic ways versus full-scale interventions. So many people are saying, not just in our country, but in virtually every country on earth today, that we are being left out, and we have to naturally prevent that from happening if we want to see a stronger citizen-led change of systems in our world. And I think it starts with youth and women. Fourth, I would say that our large institutions must practice asymmetric approaches and become more agile. It doesn't make sense to build a $700 million embassy in Baghdad when we don't have 700 Americans who could function in the language and wisely in the culture in a place like Iraq. We have a very basic standard that would keep us out of an awful lot of conflicts would be if we required that we know at least 100 local people before we send a single U.S. soldier. That doesn't mean that we send soldiers when we know 100 people, but it means that we recognize our great, great deficiencies in understanding these societies as we line up our many, many resources and our capacity to disrupt what might be a conflict, but can also complicate the situation. Fifth, I would like to say that I think we have to increase our sensitivity to personal and societal trauma. When I worked in Rwanda, after the genocide there, there was an absolute requirement that you start every conversation with a full recognition of the genocide that had just taken place. And if you didn't do that, there really wasn't a conversation to be had. But these traumas define places of violence and conflict, and we must internalize that reality. Our approaches must be grounded in respect. Keep Aretha Franklin in mind as you're approaching these places. Yes, we can build trust and hope, but we cannot solve problems for others. But building trust and hope starts with understanding what they have gone through. I remember working in Haiti, where the little priest Aristide, who was elected president a couple of times, in his first campaign, he had what I thought was one of the most effective political slogans that I had ever heard, and it was just gobbled up by his Haitian audiences, which lacked any tangible sophistication. He said that his promise was to take Haiti and Haitians from misery to poverty with dignity. And that, I think, is sort of captures both a recognition of the traumas people have been going through, but also doesn't overpromise. So it's not our job to build shining cities on a hill. Those must be self-built. But we can expand the basic freedoms of speech, assembly, and movement as foundations that will allow people to really move forward. And the final guidepost that I'd like to offer is that we have to get to know these places much, much better. And that doesn't mean one or two taxi drivers or the ministers of three national departments. It really means spending the time on the ground all over a country to get beyond our rather superficial descriptions of these places as religious wars or ethnic wars or tribal wars, or I've heard virtually every interpretation, but these are witches' brews that have been stirred usually by a male coven, and we have to spend a lot more time understanding them. So those are some of the guideposts that I try to use as, and what I'd like to do next is to offer six ambitious ideas that will engage the U.S. public in a very approachable, practical way. They're not huge ideas, but I think they still are ambitious but achievable. The first one I'd like to offer is that we have to open up the U.S. government. So we have to cut down on official secrets and classifications by 95%. You can't have a public engaged in something that they don't understand and can't see. And right now in Washington, we have over 3 million people who have secret clearance, and they're supposed to be keeping billions of secrets. My personal experience is that two people can barely keep one secret for a week. So it's a system that's fundamentally flawed, but it's also one that suggests that the American public should not really be in control. The second idea I'd like to offer is that we have to focus U.S. assistance on world's youth and women. And we have to make these populations our thematic and investment targets. And I think within that idea, we can do an awful lot of the programming that we have, but there hasn't been a thematic coherence to U.S. assistance in a long, long time. And I think it would put us on the side of history, which I believe is where we want to be, especially since we don't spend that much money in the space. Third, I think we have to build a peaceful future with China. That if this century is going to be peaceful, the United States and China are going to have to make that happen, and it's not going to be easy. But I would start with just a very simple practical idea, which is that we should have a high school exchange program between every U.S. high school and every Chinese high school. Just the simple appearance of Americans in a variety of places all over China at a youthful age when they're not pure agents of propaganda, and the same here in the United States, is something that I think will capture the imagination of local communities. Fourth, I think we have to develop joint TV, radio, social media initiatives within the U.S. and with other nations to address these mad issues, whether it's climate, conflict, disease, or cyber. We have to give people a sense of hope that our actions will matter. And the best way to do that is to start with three things that we can all do better. We know that there are personal initiatives that each of us can take, rather than assuming there has to be some central diktat that's going to tell us how we're going to change how we're going to address these issues. Fifth, I'd say we have to reduce the dominance of our militaristic approach. And a very practical way of doing that, I believe, would be to start with the appropriations hearings that take place every year for the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and for our intelligence community. I believe that the Secretaries of Defense, State, and the head of our intelligence communities should make joint appearances before the appropriators in Congress. That's one way that we start to get a broader view rather than a pipeline model that we have right now, where basically everybody fights for their own, and then they try to get a little bit more than they got the prior year. And finally, I think we've got to make a huge investment in expanding our knowledge of others. And I would like to start by calling upon the millions of Americans who have served overseas as soldiers, as diplomats, as nonprofit volunteers, to become local community ambassadors all over the United States. It's hard to find a resource like that in most countries. We have it. We think of ourselves as being relatively ignorant, and there's evidence of that, but we also have this incredible resource of people who have served and who are not called upon in any way to continue to update their fellow citizens about what's going on. So these are just a few ideas. It's just a start. I think Richard, your ambition is absolutely spot on and worthy of all the discussion you've had. I'd like to finish off by just reading sort of my closing two paragraphs of my book, because it does capture feel and what I think we need to do to mobilize our citizenry. If we start with a core respect for the people of a place, recognize their wrenching human experiences, and accept that our role is to believe in their potential, the United States will be a more effective peace builder. Trust the border of societies will grow, and we will all be safer. America will help to expand the peace. That's my ambition. And thank you for this invitation today, Richard.